This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We're ready to discuss the important events of the week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Just days after Hurricane Harvey proved to be the most expensive weather-related disaster in America's history, now Hurricane Irma, the largest Atlantic hurricane ever recorded, is poised to devastate Florida. It wreaked havoc in the Caribbean, killing at least 18 people, wrecking over 90% of the buildings in Barbuda and St. Martin. It's about to smack into Florida, and it looks like the worst-case scenarios may be coming to pass. To learn more about this, we're going to turn to Andrew.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. There's definitely a lot of worst-case scenarios here. As you mentioned, this is the largest North Atlantic hurricane ever recorded. And as of yesterday, it's also triggered the largest evacuation in U.S. history. Pretty much all of Miami, most of Florida, and even parts of Georgia have been ordered to evacuate as this hurricane prepares to make landfall sometime late tomorrow. And scientists are calling this a 1-in-100-year hurricane. It means the probability of something like this happening, according to like weather reports, are 1 in 100. But they call the Hurricane Harvey in Houston a 1 in 1,000 level storm. And so you're just kind of doing the multiplication here to actually you're just looking at, according to like weather reports, the chances of having two hurricanes this size hit within a week of each other is like 1 in 100,000 years.
It's crazy. So tell us about what the devastation that it has wreaked to this point, and basically what the folks in Florida are preparing themselves for.
Right. Well, it's already cut across the Caribbean, and it was actually a level 5 hurricane for most of its time in the Caribbean. Worked its way down to a level 4 since then, but especially a lot of these Caribbean nations have just infrastructure that is very prone to being blown over. Causing that the death tolls to be even higher there than you'd expect in America, with, as you mentioned, like 90% of the buildings in Barbuda and San Martin blown over. At least 18 people killed. That number will unfortunately be probably trending up in the coming days as you find more of the devastation as the winds die down in this hurricane's wake. And now coming in to hit Florida, which already they're saying that if it hits Miami as a level 4, people are projecting, like insurance companies are projecting, it could cost about $125 billion in damage, which is not as bad as Harvey was, but close. I mean, Harvey, they're looking at between 160 and 190 billion. So together, that's like $300 billion, almost 2% of the nation's entire gross domestic product. You normally say that a healthy economy grows by 2 or 3% each year, which means just these two natural disasters alone could wipe out pretty much all of America's net economic growth for the year 2017. Mm.
And just by comparison, Hurricane Andrew, that was 1992, wasn't it?
Yes.
I saw one photograph that superimposed Hurricane Andrew, which was quite devastating, next to a picture of Irma, and it was about half the size. How devastating have previous hurricanes been in this area, and how much does, say, $125 billion worth of damage compare with previous catastrophes like this one?
Right. I mean, I guess, and we'll see when it hits, what about the intensity? But like you said, as far as like area, like you said, yeah, this Hurricane Irma is twice the size of Hurricane Andrew, which means that it will cover twice the swath of land, which off the top of my head, from what I recall, this had adjusted for inflation. Hurricane Andrew was probably about $45 billion worth of damage. And so obviously Hurricane Irma hasn't hit yet, but they're projecting the damage to be
significantly
twice,
more than
twice yeah. what Hurricane Andrew was, just like it's twice the size.
Well, it's amazing. We've had so many radio programs just talking about these weather disasters lately, and it seems like we're going back to the same prophecies time and again, just looking at what the causes of these are. There are a lot of explanations. There are voices out there obviously blaming man-made climate change. I actually saw one celebrity said that this is Mother Nature's wrath over the presidency of Donald Trump. It's always someone who's finding a way to blame the president for the problems facing the nation. But Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory wrote a Trumpet Brief this week. This is our daily email service that you can subscribe to for free. And he gave a bit of a preview of his Key of David television program that is airing this weekend. The title of that program, 2 Chronicles 7:14, misquoted. And he spoke about the real cause of these weather disasters. That Trumpet Brief said this: one of the top leaders in the United States government has been active in recovery efforts. He stated how this land could be healed, and he quoted 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 14. One of my fellow ministers heard him and explained that this politician said, if we humble ourselves and pray, God will heal our land. But he omitted the most critical part of that verse. And he quotes 2 Chronicles 7:14. This is what the entire verse says. If my people, this is God speaking, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. So what we heard from that politician was a significantly abridged version of that verse. Mr. Flory writes, that's an absolute promise, but that American leader misquoted the verse. He left out the part about turning from our wicked ways. Is that too strong for a politician to state? Do we have wicked ways we should turn from? If you understand the Bible and what's happening in our nation today, you know that we do. He says the message in 2 Chronicles has never been more needed, but we must not omit any words. We have to see our part in the process so we can claim this marvelous promise from God. You can read that whole message from our editor-in-chief at thetrumpet.com. It's up as an article, Hurricane Irma, Is God Healing America? But I'd also encourage you to subscribe to The Trumpet Brief. If you go to thetrumpet.com, there should be a box at the top of the page giving you the option to subscribe. It's an excellent resource, having that come to your email inbox every day. And also be sure to watch Gerald Flory's Key of David program this weekend. You can find that under video, latest Key of David program, or just click on the Gerald Flory link, and it's right up there in the top right-hand corner of the page. So we'll definitely be keeping our eyes on what happens in Florida this weekend and up the eastern seaboard of the United States to see just how much damage Hurricane Irma does to that region. We're going to go now to the Middle East. We've been talking about the pressures mounting on the Jewish state of Israel. On Wednesday's program, we talked about the war games that Israel is staging in its north in order to prepare for war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. More activity yesterday after a recent report showed that North Korea was trying to send chemical weapons to Syria. Yesterday, reports are that Israel launched a strike against a chemical weapons facility in Syria. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this was an extremely rare event. It hasn't really happened in the 6 years of the Syrian civil war, this strike that the Israeli jets had against this chemical weapons facility in Syria. From how it happened was the Israeli jets, I believe they were flying over Lebanese territory, and they fired from there against this building. It's known as a building for scientific studies and research center, or that's one of the names. It's a government agency that's given to numerous facilities throughout Syria, and this one was one of those. And there was a lot of proof, according to the Israelis, that led to this attack, obviously, that led them to believe that this site was a danger for Israel's security, and then also security for the Syrian people as well, given Assad's history of using chemical weapons on his own people.
So big action taken by Israel, and this is actually 10 years after they took similar action against a nuclear facility in Syria that also was benefiting from collusion with North Korea.
Yeah, this is going back. It was almost 10 years to the exact day on September 6, 2007. We had Israel again. It was a covert strike. Israel hasn't really accepted responsibility for that one. Neither have they come out and accepted responsibility for this strike either. But back then, they destroyed an actual secret nuclear weapons facility that was involved in the production of plutonium. And that was built with the aid of North Korea as well as the Iranians. They were involved in that, and Israel destroyed that. And this is kind of this act that we saw on early Thursday morning is most similar to that. There have been numerous flights, about 100 or attacks from Israeli jets against objectives of targets inside Syria since the Syrian civil war began. But mainly they were against weapons convoys, giving weapons to Hezbollah, and Israel wanted to destroy those before they got into Lebanese territory. That's a red line for them. Now Israel is saying that the Syrian regime's governmental facilities, they are also considered a red line for us as well, given the fact that the Syrian regime, Hezbollah, and Iran look like they are converging as a united threat against Israel.
Right. So this really is in response. Viewing this in context of those recent activities that we were talking about, Iran making a stronger show of its presence on Israel's northern border, Hezbollah posing a greater threat to Israel and the war games that Israel has been staging as a means of defending against that. The defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, he says, we're going to do everything that we can to prevent a Shiite corridor from Iran to Damascus. So Israel really does, they're acting like a state with their back against the wall here.
Yeah, and indeed, that is the case. That is very much the case, and it seems like the Israelis are aware of it. And yet they're trying to get the international community on board. They're trying to reach out to Russia, reliefs, at least kind of as we talked about in the previous program a couple of weeks ago. Mr. Netanyahu went up to Russia and said, hey, can you help us out here? At least push back the Iranians from our border. They're too close to our border. Russia said we weren't going to do it. So Israel told them, well, we have our red lines. We have our red lines, Russia, and we're going to act on them if we deem it necessary for us. And this is an act that we saw. I mean, the fact that Israeli jets were willing to take this action, even though Russia probably wasn't for it, indicates that, again, they are out to look after their own, their core security interests. Now, what I find interesting from this attack is it should be an attack that is praised the world over, considering what Assad has already done. A day before this attack took place, a United Nations International Commission of Inquiry, they are a UN agency, they presented their findings that were looking into the chemical attacks that have taken place in Syria over the past 6 years. And it said that the Syrian regime has done or perpetrated at least 20 chemical attacks against their own people. They have abundant proof for that, including the sarin attack earlier this year. Yes, that was the Syrian regime. There was no proof for the what Syria said, what the Russians said. That it was a mistaken hit on an old weapons facility that blew up. No, there have been 20 chemical attacks against the Syrian people in this civil war. And even the Times of Israel was reporting that in the past couple of months, Iranians have been located at this weapons, well, at this chemical weapons facility, that apparently they've been trying to find out ways that they can work with the Syrian regime to actually put more chemical weapons on missiles. That's what they've been up to at this facility. We also talked about, I believe it was back in early August, where the North Koreans have been caught red-handed twice in the past 6 months trying to send chemical weapons parts to Syria. And so we should think there would be more global rejoicing at the fact that Israel took out such a weapons facility that has been used in the past against the Syrian people. And yet, what do we see? It's like Israel's just acting on its own.
Right. The isolation that Israel is facing is becoming clearer and clearer. And you were mentioning the Israelis seeking a certain amount of protection from the Russians. And in the absence of receiving the support that they were asking for, they go ahead and take this move. So in a sense, it is sending a message to Russia, in a sense. If you're not willing to stand up and take care of the Iranian problem, then we're going to deal with it ourselves. You could see Israel having a similar type of approach toward the United States, feeling like, well, the United States isn't helping us out, so we're going to take more radical action. You do wonder, just looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, we focus a lot on the prophecies that show Israel's desperation is going to continue to grow, that the threats facing the Israeli state are going to continue to get more severe and Israel's desperation will increase. Maybe you could just give us an overview of what we expect to happen and just how this might give us a hint of things moving in that direction.
Right. So when we're looking at this, as you said, situations like this reveal the growing isolation Israel faces, especially in the region, especially related to the threat of Iran and its proxies. And even back in 2015, we had a Trumpet cover. And on that cover, we had the world or the earth overshadowing an Israeli man waving a little Israeli flag. And it was captioned Israel versus the world. That was January 2015. And we said that Israel was isolated, that Israel was under siege. And it was back then. And it is even more so now. But as we highlighted in that article, this is going to lead Israel to search for, to accept friends that they possibly might not be so inclined to do so with, or to accept, to go after allies that they might not normally use or see as an ally. And the ally that the Bible indicates that Israel is going to go after is not who you would think. It's not the United States. It's not the United Kingdom. It's not their traditional allies. Instead, they are going to look for an ally out of this situation that we're seeing with Iran and its proxies in Europe, a German-led Europe. And the Bible is clear in that from prophecies found in Hosea. Hosea chapter 5 and verse 13 talks about how Judah is going to go to King Jareb the Assyrian for assistance in these difficult circumstances that we're seeing right now. And the Assyrians in the modern nation of Assyria is Germany. And so that's what we're looking for right now. We've been looking for Germany and Europe to get more involved in the Middle East, even separate from the Israeli issue. But they are going to come together. Germany and Europe is going to get more involved in the Middle East. And that is going to cause Israel, or at least Israel is going to see them as an ally in this fight.
All right, you gave us a lot to think about there. If someone really wants to dig into that subject in more detail, look into Hosea, the prophecy in Hosea, the identity and biblical prophecy of Germany. Where would you send them?
I would definitely go again to this book I've referred to over and over again for Stories from the Middle East and Israel, Jerusalem, and Prophecy. It lays this prophecy out very clearly and put scriptures behind it as well, so you can see how the future of Israel looks as it will look towards Germany for help.
Thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Over now to Asia. This past Sunday, North Korea carried out its sixth and most powerful nuclear test to date. It was thought to have been a hydrogen bomb, far more destructive than those it has tested before. The capabilities of this dangerous Asian state continue to surge ahead, causing a lot of consternation, a lot of fear among other world leaders. What might the effects of this latest test be? For this, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this test happened while Americans were settling into the long Labor Day holiday weekend, and it was the sixth nuclear test for North Korea, as you said, but it was the first thermonuclear detonation. So the first five nuclear detonations that North Korea has conducted starting back in 2006 were smaller weapons that used uranium, plutonium, or both for their explosive yield. And those are bombs very much like those that the U.S. dropped on Japan at the end of World War II. But this latest test on September 3rd is thought to have been a far more powerful and more compact hydrogen bomb, or a two-stage thermonuclear bomb. And a thermonuclear weapon could potentially deliver a city buster yield and potentially be miniaturized enough to fit on an intercontinental ballistic missile or some other type of missile. So it really was a big milestone for North Korea. And there was a fascinating report published a couple of days after the detonation by Geopolitical Futures. That's the intelligence firm run by George Friedman, formerly of Stratfor. And this report said that the message the North Korean test sent to America was clear. The message was that the U.S. will either have to accept North Korea as a full nuclear power, or the U.S. will have to destroy North Korean nuclear facilities while it still can. And then Geopolitical Futures says, quote, "At stake is nothing less than the regional balance of power for decades to come," end quote. And then from there, this report gets very interesting, and it begins to align very closely with the Trumpet's forecasts. It says that if Washington were to strike Pyongyang to destroy North Korea's nuclear facilities, most analysts think South Korea would back these efforts, but Geopolitical Futures says such backing from South Korea is not guaranteed, especially when you factor in pressure from China and just the U.S.'s increasingly tarnished image on the world stage there. So Geopolitical Futures said that absent that support from South Korea, the balance of power in Asia and beyond could drastically change. It says, quote, "What if a U.S. attack is predicated on South Korean involvement? What if the U.S. can't attack if Seoul doesn't participate? If this is the case, then the U.S. is simply going to have to accept North Korea as a nuclear power," end quote. And then from there, the report goes on to say that if that were the case, it would not be long before Pyongyang could use its nuclear deterrent to gradually pressure South Korea into ending its alliance with America and into ousting all those U.S. forces from the Korean Peninsula. Right now, the U.S. has 28,500 troops stationed in South Korea. But this report says, quote, "Pyongyang would use its newfound security to pressure the South into abandoning its defense treaty with the U.S. and to get U.S. troops off the peninsula. As far-fetched as it might seem, it is a viable scenario if Pyongyang possesses a nuclear deterrent."
Yeah, I think the some analysts are actually looking at this, say, from the standpoint of Kim Jong-un and saying this is pretty much what he's trying to accomplish here, is to sever that alliance between South Korea and the United States. And this is in terms of guaranteeing the long-term longevity of his regime, this would be quite a coup for him to pull off.
That's right. And this is one area, there is quite a bit of a disagreement between North Korea and its only treaty ally, China. But in that particular area, they are totally aligned. Both China and North Korea would love nothing more than to see the U.S. presence booted out of South Korea. Mm-hmm. And something like that would really change the balance of power in East Asia. It would totally undermine the credibility of U.S. security guarantees, and it would force countries like Japan to reconsider their alliance with America. Countries like that would be rushing to develop and to enhance military capabilities of their own. So it's a very sobering possibility. And this is something that The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, have said would happen for decades, because Bible prophecy is very clear that God will break the pride in America's power That's written there in Leviticus 26. And Bible prophecy shows that U.S. power will decline in Asia and everywhere else. And the Bible shows that Asian nations will rise up and become very powerful and united during an age that the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. That was the phrase that Jesus Christ used in Luke 21:24. And so we've already seen this shift happening kind of gradually for years and years. And if Geopolitical Futures is right about what a fully nuclear-capable North Korea could do, then it could lead to another massive step in that direction. So I would just really encourage listeners to order a free copy of our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. This booklet goes through all of those relevant Bible prophecies, and it ties in geopolitical trends that we see happening in the headlines every day, and just ties all that together, and it shows how this tectonic shift is happening. And it also shows that as frightening as it all is to watch, it ends with some really good news.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. I appreciate you giving us the whole picture there. You can find Russia and China in Prophecy on thetrumpet.com under the Literature tab. Really excellent book to give you the overview of what the Bible says about what's going to happen in this critical region in the world. It plays a huge role in biblically prophesied end time events. So go and check that out. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Before we take a quick break, we're going to go to Europe for an update on a story we've been following closely in advance of elections in Germany in just a couple of weeks. Big elections over there. Former Defense Minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg has been making quite an impression on the political scene. And we're very interested in him because of some strong statements in biblical prophecy about the role that German politics is going to take in end-time events. For a look at Gutenberg's activities this week, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, before I talk about exactly what Gutenberg has said over the last week, let me read to you some quotes from an interview in Spiegel magazine with an expert on German politics who'd been conducting several in-depth studies on this. And he said, on a fundamental level, German voters are totally disappointed in this election campaign. They feel like the things that are important to them aren't being discussed and that many are being glossed over. He said that in the in-depth interviews, all people wanted to talk about is the refugee crisis, the refugee crisis, refugee crisis. Despite being so elegantly left out of the campaign, it is still a sore spot that hasn't been treated by politicians. So this is something many in the mainstream are ignoring and something that everybody in the mainstream wants to have more about. And what really stands out from zu Guttenberg's speeches is that he is not afraid to go to talk about this. I don't think I have ever heard, I mean, obviously he's given a few interviews here and there, but I don't think I've ever heard him talk about migration, what it means to be German, German identity, even Europe's Christian heritage, to the same extent that we've heard him talk in his speeches over the last few weeks. This wasn't just a talking point or something that he mentioned. This was a theme of his, really the key theme of his 90-minute speech in the Guillemus Festival. It's something that's came up in some of his other discussions as well. But he said we need to have a debate about a guiding culture in society. He says everybody who comes here needs to take it personally, accept our cultures, our law, our language. And this has been something that has been talked about increasingly in the run-up to the German election, this idea of a guiding culture. It was a little bit of a taboo before this election. It's something that's being discussed more and more. Some are, especially on the left, are very against any kind of promotion of the superiority of German culture or any kind of suggestion that ultimately goes against multiculturalism, that German culture should be imposed upon those coming in, or that those coming in should be encouraged to speak the language, adopt German values. But Gutenberg is probably one of the biggest defenders of that now. So he was talking about how they should speak German. He criticized people. He said, if we're not ready to love our culture, then others will start to define our culture. He talked about political correctness. He said, well, a Christmas market is a Christmas market, and it remains a Christmas market and not a winter's feast. So very, you know, very strong defense of German culture and Christianity in Germany as well.
Yeah, I really appreciated trumpet writer Brad McDonald's trumpet brief from earlier this week, where he was talking about this very thing and just how there is so much of this sentiment within the German population that we need to do something about this, that there is a sense that we need to defend our culture against this Muslim incursion and the terrorist attacks that have been becoming increasingly a part of German life. And the fact that, well, there has been this support for maybe these far right parties, and you and I talked about the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland party, perhaps scoring a greater victory in this coming election than people would have expected. But the thing about Gutenberg is, as Mr. McDonald brought out, he's presenting himself in a way that enables the mainstream German voter, the one who feels like they would never want to identify with an AfD or something that would be perceived as far right. He presents himself as the centrist, the kind of individual that you can vote for without feeling bad about yourself. And yet he's voicing these opinions in a way that is giving them someone to identify with. He says this is part of Gutenberg appeal. The average German can embrace KT zu Gutenberg without feeling like he's supporting a far right party or a Nazi.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's just been interesting over the last couple of weeks. You know, Mr. McDonald especially, but myself as well to a lesser extent, we've been writing on this for a few years now. And then just in the about how nobody's talking about the immigration crisis, about the effect that this, the deep dissatisfaction it's causing within Germany, the hunger within Germany for someone in the mainstream to talk about this. And it's just been really interesting over the last couple of weeks to see that sentiment kind of explode into the mainstream press and to have this, you know, like that article that we read, that we quoted from in Spiegel, that Mr. McDonald also quoted from the Trumpet brief, where a lot in Germany are now saying the same thing. And you see Germany take, or zu Gutenberg taking advantage of exactly that.
Yeah, if you as a listener are unfamiliar with this man and why it is that we're focusing on him, I would really encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com. We have a whole lot of information about him very high up on the page. I'm looking at the front page of the Trumpet right now, and in our editor's picks box, we have three items about Gutenberg. There's just a lot of information there, and it points you to the biblical prophecies that we're looking at, very important prophecies. There are links to this free booklet that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote called A Strong German Leader is Imminent. He says, when this man comes to power, this world will be shocked as it has never been shocked before. Yet if you look at the whole vision, it is tied to the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. That's quite an extraordinary aspect of this that you're not going to read on any other news source besides the Trumpet, but it is the most important thing to keep in mind as we're watching this election season unfold within Germany. We appreciate that very much, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about China dealing a blow to the U.S. dollar, Pope Francis's visit to Colombia, the DACA immigration policy and what it tells us about America, and a recent archaeological discovery that sheds some light on some important history. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The American dollar's status as the world's reserve currency gives America a lot of economic power. And the Trumpet has been following the efforts of several nations to deprive America of that power. Such efforts have been going on for years with incremental success. Last week, another blow to the dollar was announced by China, which is aimed at allowing nations to buy oil futures without having to use dollars. To explain this move and why it's so prophetically significant, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China will soon introduce a crude oil futures contract that is denominated in the Chinese yuan currency and fully convertible into gold. The Nikkei Asian Review reported on this development on September 1st, and it's gotten quite a lot of attention in the finance world. China is the world's largest importer of gold, and so macroeconomists and market analysts think that this new contract could really be a game changer for the oil industry, and one that has catastrophic consequences for the U.S. dollar. And that's because the U.S. dollar, since 1973, has been the currency that OPEC countries, or the oil exporting countries, have used to price, trade, and settle all oil sales for the most part. And that's where we get the term petrodollars. So since 1973, the recycling of petrodollars into U.S. treasuries has been the lifeblood of America's economy. And it's one of the main things that has funded the U.S.'s astounding deficit spending and our debt. But now China is apparently just months away from an alternative that is not just a move away from the U.S. dollar, but it is convertible into gold. So this would really be just an irresistible option for oil exporters like Russia and Iran and Venezuela, because this futures contract will allow them to conduct sales not just in a way that avoids the dollar, but in a way that they can use the yuan that they obtained there to transfer it into gold, both on the Hong Kong and Shanghai exchanges. So these countries are not quite ready to accept being paid in yuan because they just don't have that much confidence in it yet. But with the yuan being fully convertible into gold, they no longer would have any reason at all to hesitate or doubt the security of it. Grant Williams is a finance expert who advises Volpe's investment management, and he says that he expects most oil producers to jump on this opportunity. He said, quote, "It's a transfer of holding their assets in black liquid to yellow metal. It's a strategic move swapping oil for gold rather than for U.S. treasuries, which can be printed out of thin air," end quote. And as if that were not enough for these oil producers, it's also very relevant that if they buy into these Chinese contracts, it would allow them to circumvent U.S. sanctions. These nations almost all have sanctions from the U.S. on them, which inflict quite a bit of economic damage because they're dependent on the dollar. But if they were no longer dependent on the dollar, those sanctions would lose their teeth quite a bit. And then there's also evidence that even Saudi Arabia, who has been a close partner to the U.S. for decades, could switch to these Chinese contracts, which would really rattle the foundations of the U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship. But whether the Saudis buy into it or not, the Nikkei says the launch of this contract could be a game changer for the industry. There's a reputable company called Investment Research Dynamics, which said, quote, "In addition to reducing a major source of funding for the U.S. government's enormous deficit spending, the introduction of a gold-backed yuan oil futures contract is an important step toward removing the dollar as the world's reserve currency. More significantly, it reintroduces gold into the global monetary system," end quote. And then James Corbett, he's the founder of the Corbett Report, and he called this development earth-shaking. He said, quote, "Over the course of the next year, I think we're going to be seeing some tectonic shifts taking place monetarily, geopolitically, and as a result, potentially militarily," end quote. So a lot of analysts just think that this is going to totally upend one of the largest industries on the planet and deal a major blow to the U.S. dollar. And that is something that The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, have been warning would happen for about five decades now. All the way back in 1968, The Plain Truth's editor-in-chief, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, discussed the dire economic conditions that would afflict the United States in the end time. He said, quote, "If the dollar is devalued, inflation will almost surely result in eventual economic collapse for the United States," end quote. So that was in 1968. And then over the next 20 years after that, Mr. Armstrong's forecast on that topic became just even more specific. In 1984, he wrote that a massive banking crisis in America could, quote, "suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the United States. That, in turn, could bring on the Great Tribulation suddenly, and that will lead quickly into the second coming of Christ and the end of this world as we know it. End quote. So Mr. Armstrong was looking at Bible prophecies in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 and elsewhere, and he was saying that a financial crisis in America and the decline of the U.S. dollar could be a major factor in just devastating the whole country and then leading to so many of those end-time prophecies that the Bible discusses.
Yeah, it also makes me think of the economic siege that we've talked about so much and just how much we've talked about China playing a big role in fulfilling that prophecy that's in Ezekiel 5 and Ezekiel 4, and just freezing the United States out of markets Mr. Armstrong talked about that as well, that these countries converging and basically creating a trade relationship that the United States is not a part of. And he specifically talked about South America and China and Russia being a part of that. So these states that you're mentioning, these big oil-producing states, it is interesting to see how much that aligns with those exact forecasts that Mr. Armstrong made.
Yes, that's exactly right. So that's really why this new Chinese contract is something that the Trumpet is keeping a very close eye on. If it does end up luring the oil exporting nations such as Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and the others away from the U.S. dollar and to that gold-backed yuan option, then it could very quickly cause, as James Corbett said, earth-shaking outcomes, and you could see how that could play into all of those prophecies that we've been watching for.
Yeah, this is also another interesting note. It came to mind that in Ezekiel 7 and verse 19, there's a prophecy that says, "They shall cast their silver in the streets, and their gold shall be removed. Their silver and gold shall not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord." And the context of that verse is towards the end of a period of time known as the Great Tribulation. But just thinking about it, if people are throwing their gold in the streets at the end of the tribulation, it means they had to have it in the first place at the beginning. And so it could definitely be an indication that gold and silver specifically will play a much bigger role than dollars as a reserve currency in the months and years ahead.
Well, we appreciate that very much, Jeremiah. We're going to go now to a big political story in the United States. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced on Tuesday that the Trump administration intends to end a policy, an Obama-era policy, called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. This is a big immigration move that President Obama made via executive order in 2012. A lot of people are up in arms over President Trump's administration making this decision, and that in itself tells us a lot about what's happening in the United States today. To learn about the significance of this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Well, you're definitely right about the people being up in arms over this. I mean, if you go more towards like far left sources like Common Dreams or things like that, there are people condemning this as a sick, a white supremacist, white nationalist agenda. But even more mainstream politicians like former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and even former President Barack Obama have come out and condemned this decision as cruel. So you can see that there's a bit of anger building over the rescinding of this policy, but it is just really important to take a step back, even just 5 years into history, to kind of see what's the context of this law. And this is actually a law that was put into place by executive order by President Obama, to where he they'd proposed legislation in Congress in 2012 saying, okay, we want to grant amnesty to anyone who entered the United States before their 18th birthday or any parent of a child who has a child who came with them into the United States before their 18th birthday. Congress refused to pass that legislation. And for a number of years, actually 22 separate times over his presidency, Barack Obama had come out and said, he's like, well, I want this amnesty bill, but Congress has refused to pass it, and I'm not a king, so I can't just unilaterally make a law. And eventually, around 2012, he had a bit of a change of heart there and decided that he was going to unilaterally make this law. And even though Congress passed nothing, he just came out and he said, well, if Congress won't act, I will. From here on out, I'm not deporting any illegal minors or anyone who used to be a minor at some point in the past when they came into the United States. And this was something that was challenged in the courts, and a number of state courts condemned it as unconstitutional. And so when the Trump campaign, this was a campaign promise of his, that he's like, said, well, I'm going to restore the rule of law, or at least attempt to restore the rule of law. And if Congress doesn't grant an amnesty bill, then, well, the Constitution gives Congress power over immigration. I can't just refuse to deport people who entered the United States as minors. And even that, this announcement you mentioned this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said, he says, we're giving Congress 6 months to make a decision. So actually, even the Trump administration is refusing to enforce this law that's currently on the books. They said, we're going to continue doing like Obama, and we're not going to enforce this law for 6 months. But then if Congress hasn't done anything, we'll have to start enforcing. And as we've pointed out, we have a video on the website that I did earlier this week that was posted this morning, just pointing out the fact that this, regardless on your particular stance on immigration policy in the United States, something every American should agree on, right-wing American, left-wing American, conservative, liberal, progressive, whatever, you should be able to agree on that. It's important to uphold the rule of law. We have a system where Congress makes laws, the president enforces them, and this court interprets the Constitution. When you start allowing the president to just willy-nilly decide what laws he's going to enforce or not enforce, or even start issuing proclamations, making up new laws that Congress never passed, there's nothing to restrain him from basically doing whatever he can get away with, whatever he's got public support for. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we've really hit our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has really hit hard in his book, No Freedom Without Law. That book's a lot of parts about the importance of people following God's law, but he also points the importance of just upholding a law is greater than yourself, being just so stable for the stability of a society. Once you start realizing, like, okay, well, the will of the leader is more important of the law, that eventually leads to just widespread instability. And you've seen that in the United States a lot today with people like protesting, sometimes even violently, decisions that a president or Congress has legally made, saying, well, we didn't get our way, so we're going to protest. And there's no consideration for, like, okay, well, was it legal or was it lawful? And once that starts really spiraling out of control, you get anarchy in society. And there are, dozens, more than dozens of prophecies in the Bible throughout Ezekiel and Isaiah, and even in the New Testament in Matthew, about the anarchy that's going to get so bad that no flesh would be saved alive if Christ didn't return. It's a complex topic, the rule of law. So Mr. Flair points out in his book that it's a very sophisticated thing to be able to put out the rule of a law as greater than the will of a person. And so for anyone who's just really interested in just how vital that is to society, we just really highly recommend that No Freedom Without Law booklet.
Yeah, it seems like that one, and also America Under Attack, which exposes the meaning behind so many of those acts that were enacted, those executive orders by the Obama administration that were undermining the rule of law and really putting policies in place that were not in America's best interest. America Under Attack explains that. That's also available at thetrumpet.com. Both of those booklets. And then you can also, as Andrew mentioned, watch that video that he made, What You Need to Know About DACA. That's right up on the top of the front page of thetrumpet.com. So go and check that out. We appreciate that, Andrew. Well, thetrumpet.com has a companion website, watchjerusalem.com. It focuses on events in this biblically crucial city and just how events there are fulfilling the prophecies of the Bible. That website also focuses on history and archaeology. The top story right there now regards a recent find, a trove of bulla, or small clay seals, that provide evidence for what happened to a number of Israelites who escaped Assyrian captivity. That's written about in the Bible. For this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem, the man who oversees the Watch Jerusalem website, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, so this was recently found, I think, in the last week or so, a trove of bulla, or seal impressions, as you said, that come from about 2,700 years ago. They were excavated in the City of David, which is just south of the Temple Mount, the most ancient part of Jerusalem, just up from the Gihon Spring, if people are familiar with their Jerusalem geography. And what's interesting about these bulla, or the names that are on them, they don't have biblical names or biblical personalities per se written on them, but they do have biblical names, or names that are mentioned in the Bible. For example, my first name is Brent, my last name is Nachtigall. These don't have Brent Nachtigall, but they do have Brent. They do have names that we would be familiar with. Now, these names on these bulla specifically are interesting because they feature names that are typically associated with the northern kingdom of Israel. People remember that Israel is divided into two kingdoms around the time of King Jeroboam after Solomon and Rehoboam. And the 10 tribes went with the north, and the 2 tribes went with the south, and then the third tribe, the Levites and the Benjamites and Judeans, stayed in the south. And they had different names that that stayed within their families of the different tribes. And what we've found, or what they've found this past week, is we have the appearance of northern Israelite names, familiar Israelite names, names such as Menachem or Phinehas, as we would anglicize it, appearing on these bulla down in Judah at a specific time. So why are these names showing up? And what the archaeologists have come out and discussed is that the appearance of these names testify to an immigration of people from the northern kingdom of Israel to the southern kingdom of Judah. And then they looked in the Bible and they find that during the time of King Hezekiah, we have just exactly that. When the northern tribes were beginning to go into captivity, we actually have some of those people, some from some of those 10 tribes in the north, flooding down into Judah to keep the Passover, and then with Hezekiah, and then they stayed there. They stayed there after the northern tribes went into captivity. There was a few Israelites there, and the presence of Israelite names in Judah from that time seemed to testify to the accuracy of that biblical event.
Very interesting. I would encourage people to go to watchjerusalem.com. There's an article up there, Ancient Seals Discovery, Israelite Refugees, and it actually has a video there that shows the bulla that have been discovered, gives more of a biblical context to what Brent was discussing there. Very interesting, and like so many of the archaeological finds from Jerusalem, underlining the biblical account and providing more evidence of the Bible's accuracy as a historical document. We appreciate that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're coming to the end of the program here. You can visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on the program today. Give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Great to be here.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of George Washington Carver. I love to think of nature as an unlimited broadcasting station through which God speaks to us every hour if we will only tune in. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, Keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.